It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. In the news, lots about people being fired for not being vaccinated. Now, here's the thing. I know what it's like to be fired. I have been fired before. It's happened a number of times. Generally, they come in and go, there's the door, get out, don't come back. Because you did something wrong. You broke something, you didn't show up, whatever. What we're seeing right now is not employers firing people as much as we're going, sorry, you know, the law is what it is. You have not complied. In fact, the big story was we're going to see all of these police and all these firefighters and all these military personnel and all these nurses. They're all going to get fired. We're going to be a mass exodus. I guess one state trooper in Massachusetts. I guess 150 employees at the Christiana Care Hospital and I guess 175 in North Carolina. But the headline, oh my goodness, the headline, Christiana Care fires 150 employees for not complying with COVID vaccine mandate. Now you go, oh my God, 150 people got fired. This is a 906-bed, 1.3 million square foot facility with more than 10,000 employees. So out of 10,000 employees plus, 150 of them failed to get the vaccine. I'm sorry, I don't know that should have been the blaring headline. I don't know that the giant, bold-type North Carolina hospital system fires about 175 workers in one of the largest ever mass terminations due to vaccine mandate. You go, hold on. The hospital system they're talking about in North Carolina, three times as big as the one in Delaware, 35,000 employees, 35,000 plus, and you've got 175? And that gets the headline? This is the craziness of where we are. This is the insanity of this whole scenario. You've got a handful of people who are gumming it up for everybody else. And we've got a media structure that they love to, fight. They love to keep people all, I got to buy the paper. I got to read it. I got to know. When the reality is we're talking about a slim minority of the people who are boogering it up for everybody else. And this is where I'm struggling in this moment to really kind of care. Because what we know is people right now, man, we're tired. We're tired of the masks. We're tired of the looking and seeing the number of deaths going up, the number of people being hospitalized, and the number of ICU beds going down, the restrictions and the... Just tired of it, man. Tired of it. And the thing is we lived through years of the right-wing loons telling people, F your feelings. Well, you know what? It seems that is boomeranged back as the majority of us are now saying, F your hesitancy. We want our lives back. We want to get somewhere back to the normal place. And you're the one standing in the way. You're the one screwing it up for everyone else. So you didn't get fired. You made a choice. And that choice came with a consequence. This is what the choice people want. You have a choice to go somewhere else. And I've been saying this for years on a bunch of topics. You know, I have people say, well, I should never have to join a union. You don't have to. You can leave. And this is the same thing. In a workplace where the vast majority of people want to be safe, the vast majority of people do not want to be around unvaccinated people who could conceivably get them sick. Don't want it. Don't need it. It's a consequence. So they weren't fired. They made a choice. So this is my problem with some of the dishonest headline writing that we see. They weren't fired. If they get the vaccine, yes, you know, they can come back. Generally, that's how it works. These companies don't want to get rid of people. They're having a hard enough time finding people to come to work. But ultimately, this is a moment where if we're not going to be big boys and girls, if we're not going to be responsible, somebody has to. And this is where Biden's mandate, and I think it's the right choice. I think he did the right thing. This emergency temporary standard that they've issued through the Department of Labor, through Occupational Safety and Health, is saying, look, you know, we got to protect people in the workplace. I've been saying this from the start, that we needed OSHA to have a policy to make sure that there's a ground floor. That when you come to work, just like with any number of things, chemical exposure, making sure that there are safety guards on machinery, any of that stuff, that workers are protected when they come to work. And Biden's plan is any private employer with more than 100 employees got to get vaccinated. Got to do it, or you've got to get tested weekly. They threw that in there as well. And as I said, this is something that is long overdue. Now, there are people saying, well, we'll sue, and I assume they will. But again, this is another one of those things where now you're looking at the Supreme Court and going, do they undo 116 years of decided law and overturn what was the Jacobson versus Massachusetts case that said, yeah, we can vaccinate people like they did against smallpox during an epidemic? Can do that. No, you have the choice. You have choice. I'm not in favor of holding anybody down and jamming them in the arm. I'm not in favor of tricking them into it. You got to want to protect yourself. But ultimately, if it comes down to your rights superseding my rights, we have a problem. And this is where we are. The vast majority of people, 77% of people in this country who are eligible to get the shot have gotten at least one of them. That means 23% across the whole population. And in healthcare, we're talking a small sliver, an incredibly small minority. And this is one of those things where if I'm going to the hospital, and this is where hospitals, I think, are different, schools as well. I think hospitals are different in the place where these are people who already have major problems. These are people who have, immune problems. These are folks who have comorbidities. These are problems who are already struggling. And now you're going to introduce someone who might be dangerous to them. It makes no sense. And like I said, I've been saying all along, capitalism is deciding, because these employers don't want these people around patients, because that means lawsuits. If they allow unvaccinated people into the hospital, someone gets it, and, well, lawsuits. This is where, if we can't be big boys and girls, capitalism decides. Now, what they're saying is Biden's mandate is going to affect somewhere around 80 million, about 80 million people who work in employers that employ more than 100 people. Going to be interesting to see where this plays out. Now, what we know is, like I said, people are fed up. People are tired. And it's getting worse. I just saw this annual Women in the Workplace report from McKinsey and Company and leanin.org. And what they found is, last year you had people who were, women were about 32% of them were burnt out. Men, about 28% were burnt out. This year, that number has jumped to 42% of women, 35% of men, because it's getting much harder in the workplace. You hear these stories of people at Walmart or fast food restaurants or restaurants, just any of these the customers always write nonsense places where these people feel entitled to beat up on these workers. They've had enough of it. And they're fed up with it. And this again is where one, as somebody who firmly believes in the right of workers to collectively bargain and fight for better wages, hours, conditions, but also having a voice and protection is a huge part of this. No worker should be abused in the workplace. No worker should be talked down to, yelled at, belittled. Any of the things that we see coming out of these vax holes. I'm really struggling with that. And, you know, here's the thing. We're going to be getting on a plane not too long. I'm waiting for one of these anti-mask idiots to just pop off for no reason. What, interesting, sidebar. Marjorie Taylor Greene caught wearing a mask at an airport. Shows that she's not a complete and total pain in the neck all the time. That's a good thing. There could be progress. Could be. But I look at this and we're in this moment. And what's frustrating is there are those minority, the loudest minority who want to keep us. They want to keep us all bunched up. And understand, this has now become solely political in my mind. I don't buy anymore that it's that people have this hesitancy. I think it's now a political stance more than a health stance. This is now political stuff. This is now the Republican Party, you know, feeding these folks and wanting to make sure that they're angry because they need the anger. They need the right wing needs the rage machine needs it. They need the grievance. They need the issue. But here's the thing. The majority of people, not with them on this, the majority of the people want to get back to life the way it used to be, where we didn't have to worry who was standing behind us in line, where we didn't have to worry about our kids going to school because, well, some idiot has decided, no, I want to see my beautiful child smile because we're drenched in the blood of Jesus or whatever voodoo they claim to believe. All because they don't want to wear a mask. So here in the state of Pennsylvania, our Republican-led Senate, which has gone, you know, pretty much full-on crazy, passed today a piece of legislation, Senate Bill 846, sponsored by the guy who went down to the insurrection, Senator Doug Mastriano, and Judy Ward. It came out of the Education Committee. And what it will do, if they get it passed through the full Senate, and I believe they will, it's going to give parents or the guardians of kids the ability to opt their children out of mask mandates. No health reasons. No, they don't even have to make up a religious reason. They've just decided that they've done their research, mouth gaping on YouTube, saw a post on Facebook, someone sent them something by carrier pigeon, whatever. But they've decided that no, not gonna let them want them to have wear a mask, and that they should be unleashed on the rest of our kids, so that they're going to be able to decide over the school. Now, again, this will get vetoed because this is more of that politicization. This is more of the Republicans going, no, we need to feed more red meat. We need to get these people angrier and angrier so that they keep giving us money and we keep being torn apart. But stop and think about what the intent of this legislation is. The ability to say, you know what? We're above your rules. We're above sanity. We're above common science that someone who probably barely passed high school biology is now, they're now the ones who are going to decide and be free of consequence. Look, if you don't want your kid to wear a mask, there's a process for that. You can educate them at home. You can send them to parochial school. You can send them to a private school. You can do all kinds of things. You have choices and there are consequences with those choices. But to say that we're going to opt our kids out so that your kids are going to be less safe is insane. But this is what the current Republican Party believes. And it's not all of them. Or it'll be interesting to see, find out if it is. I hope it's not all of them. I'm hoping there are still some in that party who go, you know what, public health kind of is important. The general welfare, kind of something that we need to look out for. Now, I also find it interesting that they have simultaneously moved along with this. And this is the part that I go, aha, here it is. They want to move money away from the school districts. They have moved on House Bill 1254 here in Pennsylvania that would take money away from property taxpayers through public education and subsidize what they are calling education coupons. Not quite a voucher. It is. It's a voucher. But they've got a new name for it. It's a new name. They've rebranded the bad idea of school vouchers, and now we're calling them school coupons. Yeah. And again, this is to feed their ideology. This is to feed their ideological donors. This is about getting public money. And again, this is brilliant. Never let a good crisis go to waste. This is about taking public school money and handing it over to religious organizations. That's the end game. So when you stop and you look at all this stuff and you go, it's always the money. Really, it is. And it never gets any more difficult than it's always about the money. It's always about following the paper trail and into whose pocket it goes. And for me, this looks like, well, pretty simple. We're going to inflame parents over the mask issue. When we know that in those kind of environments, good ventilation in the classroom, social distancing, the masks, it works. And in fact, I give my local school district credit. According to my kids, the kids in the school are doing a great job of making sure that they wear their masks. They do the social distance. Because what? Guess what? The kids, they don't want to go back. They don't want to go back to virtual. They don't want to go back to sitting in their room 20 hours a day. They want to be in school. So if this is what it's going to take, the kids are smarter than the parents. And I got to wonder, it's one of those moments where I wonder if you're one of the parents who goes, no, we shall not wear masks. If the kid wears the mask to school, does the kid get in trouble? I mean, how weird of a society have we become when the kids seem to be a lot smarter than the parents? Or at least our Republican leaders, who, again, it really is about the money. Education coupons? couldn't you come up with something else? Is this one of those things where they looked up in the thesaurus and go, oh, what's a different word for voucher that somebody might not get? Very, very bizarre. But look, it is Senator Doug Mastriano who evidently it's claimed that, borrowed some material for his book from other places. I guess that's a nice way of saying it. But I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back.
On the Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1965. That was the day the Delano grape strike began in California. The strike came a year after activists had forced Congress to end the Bracero contract labor program. The Filipino Agricultural Workers Organizing Committee, led by Larry Itilong, Philip Vera Cruz, and others, called the strike against the Delano growers and the Coachella Valley grape growers. It had been a record harvest. Farm workers demanded higher wages, humane working conditions, and union recognition. When the growers refused, thousands walked out of the fields. A week later, the Mexican-American National Farm Workers Association, led by Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta, joined the strike. It was a historic moment. Within a year, the two unions would merge to form the United Farm Workers. The union sent strikers to the Oakland docks to persuade the longshoremen not to load non-union grapes. Many of the Filipino workers in the San Joaquin Valley worked in the Alaska fish canneries organized by the ILWU in the off-season. And so the ILWU honored their union brothers' request. Thousands of cases of grapes were left to rot on the docks. This initial victory led Chavez to organize a grape boycott against heavyweights DiGiorgio and Shenley Industries. 6 months into the strike, union leaders marched 300 miles from Delano to Sacramento to bring attention to their struggle. They hoped to pressure growers to the negotiating table and legislators to act on their behalf. For 5 years, the strike and boycott continued with marches, organizing, and picket line arrests. Gradually, the UFW began winning higher wages, union recognition, and hiring halls. Finally, in 1970, a collective bargaining agreement covering 10,000 workers was reached.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So let the fun begin. That's right. The fun is clock ticking, tick, tick, tick. We're closing in on another government shutdown. Thank you, GOP. We're just hours away from running out of money to pay the bills for the money that we've already spent. This is the weird part for me, because this isn't say, hey, we're going to argue over spending. This is to say, no, we're just not going to pay the bills. That's how freaky this is. So it looks like Mitch McConnell and the GOP have set hell-bent on another 800,000 government workers working without a paycheck because, you know, last night they decided all 50 of them, they are going to block a temporary funding extension that would keep our government open just a couple more days. So it looks like maybe the end of the week we could have, you know, a fun weekend. And here's some thoughts on what kind of weekend to expect. I've asked our good friend Phil Glover to come talk with us. Phil is the Vice President of District 3 of the American Federation of Government Employees, AFGE. Phil, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick. Appreciate you having me back.
So am I getting this right? We're ticking down. The clock is ticking to what I think most of us expect will be the next shutdown.
Yeah, midnight on the 1st. Funding ends, you know, the first day of the fiscal year is October 1st. They're supposed to have all of the appropriation bills done, and they're supposed to have all the funding in place for the next year. And that hasn't happened, of course. And so now we're going to sit here and wait to see the machinations of Congress and see what happens to our members. Basically, we're at their mercy again.
And what's crazy to me, and as I said at the beginning here, the sad reality is this isn't fighting over spending. The money's already been allocated. We've already gone through the process where you should have fought over this. This is now just saying, no, we're going to punish people who have really nothing to do with it because we've got some weird political position that I don't even know why this time. Look, I understood some of the other ones. You go back to the ticking bomb of the Obama era. They wanted Screwquester. They wanted some pound of flesh. I'm not seeing what this pound of flesh is just yet.
No, I mean, the debt ceiling debate, number one, it's very, you know, it's so complicated. It's not a bumper sticker, right? But, you know, in 2019, they did a two-year deal to extend the debt limit. Everybody voted for it. There wasn't any, you know, nobody tried to hold it up. You know, this was under the previous administration. And so we piled on all kind of debt. And obviously under COVID, we've had to pile on some debt to take care of people and do the things that need to be done. And now we're not going to pay for it, basically. And we're going to tie it to the, you know, we don't want to pay workers. And we're going to tie it together to where, you know, we're not going to get paid. Debt ceiling's not going to get taken care of. So everybody loses.
Yeah.
No, and that's where we are.
No, and it's crazy. I mean, you know, I have a friend who was a former congressman who says, you know, this used to be a yawn vote. We already spent the money. It has to be done. And it's his view. We shouldn't even have a debt ceiling because the time to fight over this stuff is, you know, like you would do in your household. If you're bumping up, you know, near a certain spot, maybe you think about, you know, arguing over the spending instead of, you know, well, how do we pay for it? Maybe we argue that first and then it'll take care of itself down the road.
Well, exactly. I mean, the appropriation bills are, I think a lot of them are done. I mean, for many of the issues of government, Department of Defense, VA, a lot of those are put together. The House has passed a number of them, but here we are again, you know, at the deadline, you know, and we're just, you know, our members, we're just sick of it. I mean, frankly, I don't care anymore. Who's responsible? Someone, the adults better get in a room and try to figure out how to fix this because it's not right that members that work in TSA and Bureau of Prisons and Border Patrol and VA and everywhere else across government, have to worry about putting gas in their tank to go to work, because they're all going to get ordered to go to work every day. And they don't get to stay home. You know, these congressmen want to talk about a vacation for federal workers when these government shutdowns happen. You know, there's a lot of worry, a lot of, you know, consternation, a lot of problems, you know, with people having to pay their bills if you start missing paychecks.
Yeah, no.
And,
we saw that back during the former guy's term. Because
we had a 35-day shutdown. And that shutdown, and I just kind of, you know, for this interview, I kind of went back. $11 billion it cost the economy, that 35-day shutdown. And here we are again playing around with this. I you know, and back then, all these members of Congress from each side of the aisle, oh, we're never going to do this again. This was a clear warning. We shouldn't do it. And here we are again. Here we are again. So it's just time that these people take that aside, fund government, pay the government workers, and get this settled. Deal with policy issues in some other form, some other fashion.
Now, you'll hold, maybe beat up on somebody else, because this is another one of those scenarios where, you know, the people who have the least ability to control their destiny are the ones who this is being taken out on. And it is really just a purely political move. And you know, but here's the thing, and I go back to, and the reason I brought up the former guy is, you know, the reality is they raised the debt, you know, in enormous amounts. Even without the pandemic, they were still $1 trillion plus debt in deficits every year. And then you throw the pandemic money on it, just, I think it was almost $8 trillion that they added. And the Democrats didn't do this kind of scorched earth scenario stuff that we're seeing out of the Republicans. So for me, I come back to this idea that this is just about slowing down the infrastructure bill, slowing down the Build Back Better plan. This is their only way to hold things up and to grind government to a halt so nothing gets done, so they can have a political advantage next year.
And I think a lot, you know, a lot of our members like to look at this and say, well, it's both sides. In that case, in the 2019 debt ceiling bill, when that was all put into the budget, the Democrats didn't stomp their feet and say, no, we're not going to raise the debt ceiling. They came up with a plan. They agreed with the Republicans to do it. This is Mitch McConnell. This is classic McConnell. When there's a Democratic president, this is what he does. And the Democrats generally don't play this kind of game with the money, with the funding. And so, yeah, I agree with you on a lot of that, but I do still think that our members deserve to be paid. And I think they need to find a way to get around this, whatever they have to do. We should not be penalized again. We shouldn't go through another shutdown. It's enough.
No, it is. And for me, it means there's so much that needs to be done. We're still fighting with this pandemic. We're still trying to get the economy to recover. We need massive investments for the future of this country. I mean, there's so much that needs to happen. And this is kind of like, for me, the last thing we need at this moment, which is why I come back to my conclusion that the only thing I can possibly think of, the reason for this, is that this is going to slow down our ability to get anything done, which is going to make Democrats look bad in 2022.
Well, exactly. And then the other part of this is, like, yeah, as you were saying, we're still fighting this pandemic off. So you have COVID issues. You have the CDC that's funded from the government. You've got, you know, all of these different government agencies that are dealing with the pandemic, HHS, all these large entities that get funded in these bills. And, you know, those people, you're going to send all the scientists home. You're going to send the doctors home. What are you doing? We have VA who's treating veterans. Do we want to not fund the Veterans Administration? Do we want to have Veteran Administration employees not paid, having to come to work? And again, and then you look at your safety agencies, you know, ICE, Border Patrol, prisons, TSA, make them go to work without pay. Again, this is just, it's just unacceptable at this point to all of us. And yeah. And I really encourage Congress to find a way here. They've got to find a way to not do this time.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people focus on the, a lot of people are focused on the, you know, the minor inconveniences. Oh, they're going to close state parks, and you know, those kind of things are going to happen. But when the Social Security checks stop coming, and Granny doesn't have any food, or when we don't have people showing up to make sure that we have clean water or clean air, or you know, OSHA, the folks who are going to be the ones to enforce this vaccine mandate and safe working conditions on the job, bad things can happen.
Well, I think, you know, as with the last shutdown, at first, nobody really pays a lot of attention. But after about 2 weeks, somebody can't get a passport. Somebody can't do this. Somebody can't do that. And even though you say, you know, national parks, you've got people on vacation probably at Yellowstone right now. You've got people with different national parks across the country. They'll be told on Friday, see you, pack up your stuff. You have to leave the park. That's what happened last time. And people started screaming because they planned for a vacation for 3 years and saved the money. And now, you know, because Congress can't get along and can't figure out how to fund government, you know, that it impacts the public. Yeah. And these things, you know, I think last time people got really angry about the Statue of Liberty being closed. I mean, it was just there was a lot of anger about it because I can remember Park Service employees who we represent telling us how upset, you know, the public was that they couldn't go out to the statue. And it seems like a small thing, but to a lot of people, they save for a couple years to go make that trip. Yeah. And then you have something like this happen.
Yeah. Now we're going to be flying here in the you know, beginning part of October. I've got something I have to do in Alaska, and you know, I'm thinking, you know, is it possible the air traffic controllers, you know, aren't going to get paid and they don't come and I don't get to come home? Do I need to start a contingency plan to where I'm going to be, you know, stuck in Alaska for a month? Well, I'm not complaining. My wife's doing the thumbs up, but you know, do I have to start planning for this stuff? Because who knows how long this takes? Who knows how deep this can go? And sadly, you know, this is the kind of uncertainty that you cannot have to run a first world country. This is not how you run a lemonade stand, Phil.
No. And then, you know, last time we were fortunate that we had the flight attendants union, FAA, a number of the transportation unions were with us. And frankly, we had a lot of members, you know, and again, our members are not paid like some people think. They think federal workers are all, you know, we're not all lawyers. We're not all doctors. You know, a lot of people are making GS2, GS3 pay. You know, TSA workers are hourly. Some are part-time. And, you know, we ended up using food banks. We ended up having other unions provide us with assistance for our members. And, you know, now we've reciprocated and tried to help them during their strikes or things that they have going on. But people just, you know, they don't understand that stuff. I get it. But, you know, I don't want to see that again. And none of us. And I really, you know, we're going to be lobbying the rest of this week. We've been lobbying. I know that our members, we're gearing them up with text messages. We're trying to get them to contact their members of Congress that way and by email. So we are pushing those things. And We're gonna try to get this thing stopped by Friday.
Yeah, no, it absolutely needs to happen. So walk me through real quick. I know there are contingency plans in place. I know they've been working through them the last couple of days, as if things are going to shut down. What are the first things that go? I mean, you know, so that we kind of understand, you know, how this process works, this kind of controlled shutdown, how this works. Walk me through a little bit about how you see it working out.
Yeah, it's kind of a strange process, really. Like, they're not allowed to authorize leave. They start to call people back in. I know when I worked in the Bureau of Prisons and there were shutdowns in 13, they actually called us back to work, even though we were on annual leave, but they can't pay out annually. So they start to order you back to work. And we had more staff on site than what we needed to have. You know, they will start to notify agencies to shut down that are, and I call them this only because this is the term that's used. They will start to shut down non-essential agencies, or that's what they call them. Well, those are just agencies that, you know, will remain at home and not be in the office. Under COVID, we may actually keep some people working telework that normally would have been shut down and sent home. I don't know, but that means they're still working without pay. And, you know, if they're kept on, then they're owed. So they start to shut the agencies down. They have contingency plans to shut buildings down, shut off, you know, whole floors, all the things that you have to do. The Park Service starts to shut down exhibit sites, lock them down, all of that kind of stuff happens. And you'll see, you know, by Friday afternoon, you'll see people being sent home. Yeah. And they will be told not to report back.
But for the big things like Social Security, like the VA, like our military people and the health care that they get, that's not going to be affected right away.
Well, what has happened in the past is those agencies that have these that like DOD civilians and like VA doctors and nurses, they'll be told to report. Bureau of Prisons will be told to report to work, and all of the law enforcement agencies. The federal meat inspectors will be told to report to work. They just won't be paid. And now, you know, at first you're not going to lose a paycheck for a couple of days because you're working off your last 2 weeks, as everybody does.
Right.
It just depends on how deep this shutdown goes. And, last time we never thought it was going to get to 35. Prior to that in 2013, I think it was 16 days. So we had a partial non-payment. We had people getting a partial paycheck. And that hurt too. I mean, they were shocked because that first week's paycheck, they take all the deductions. So, and I had that happen to me early on in my correctional when I was a GS6. We were on a shutdown and opened up the paycheck and they had taken all my deductions for that week. So I ended up with $150.
Wow.
You know, for a 2 week paycheck.
So last question I've got for you, because, you know, clearly we've got to do something. What's the marching order? What are we telling people?
We are calling Congress. We are hitting the switchboard. You know, there's two switchboard numbers for the House and Senate. We are emailing and texting a link to send a note to your member of Congress. Keep the government open. Find a way. We're not, you know, I'm not playing politics with this. Keep the government open. I don't care what you need to do as a congressman, but you need to figure out a way.
Well,
mostly Senate.
Right.
As we know, it's the Senate. The House passed the bill to keep the government open. The Senate is, you know, 50-50 Senate. Here we are.
And that idiotic cloture vote is what's holding this up. But, Phil, I wish you the best. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
Appreciate it, Rick. Take care.
Good stuff. Our good friend Phil Glover, Vice President, AFGE District 3. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Gonna take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. Would you be willing to stand up in solidarity with your fellow workers, even if it cost you your job? Well, on this day in labor history, the workers at Mersey Docks and Harbor Company in Liverpool, England, answered that question. The year was 1995. 329 Mersey dock workers refused to cross a picket line that was being walked against another company on the docks. The workers at Torside had been fired for protesting against erosions in job security and increasingly unpredictable scheduling. They were speaking out against the casualization of their labor. When the Mersey dock workers would not cross the Torside picket line, they too were fired. Dock workers across the world stood up in solidarity with the Mersey workers against this unjust treatment. They knew if it could happen in Liverpool, it might happen anywhere. Pickets sprung up from Norway to Japan, from Australia to Italy, and into the United States. It was a global outpouring of solidarity. The strike wore on for 850 days. 1 year into the strike, dock workers held an International Day of Action in support of the Liverpool workers. Finally, 2.5 years after they were fired, the dock workers agreed to a settlement. They did not get their jobs back, but they did get severance pay. A film was made about the struggle. The proceeds were used to purchase a bar in Liverpool. It is known as the Dockers Pub. and has become a space for working class organizing. The International Dock Workers Council was also born from this strike. Today, the council has 90,000 members, a lasting movement of solidarity. 20 years after the strike, dock workers from across the world gathered in Liverpool to remember the struggle.
Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So some good news this week. And again, I put this in the category of this is Joe Biden's doing. Thanks to the Biden Build Back Better plan. Thanks to the rhetoric coming out of this administration about making things in America, reshoring our manufacturing. The Ford Motor Company made what is their largest investment in manufacturing in this country in 118 years, as they're going to bring a couple of plants to build batteries for the next generation of electric vehicles. They said $11.4 billion of investment. They say this is going to create about 11,000 new jobs in these three battery plants. I guess there's two in Kentucky, one going to be in Tennessee, but we're going to build them here. That's important stuff. And I give credit to Joe Biden and the administration, because it's their push, in my view, that got us there. And here to share some thoughts on, well, this historic announcement, what it means and what it could mean for the industry as a whole going forward, I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, their website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it is great to be with you, especially with some pretty awesome news for manufacturing like this.
So you agree with me? I'm in this place where I'm giving Biden credit for this. I think this is a big part of what's come out of his plan. The push for Buy American, the push for Buy Union, I think, is a huge part of this.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, ultimately, the company wants to make money. It's not doing this out of any sort of altruism or loyalty. It's going to invest money where it thinks it can make money. And it thinks it can make money by making lithium ion batteries and electric vehicles in America. And I think you're right. There's a couple of aspects of Biden's policies that I think are pushing companies in this direction. One is building demand, and everything the Biden administration is doing on clean energy, on vehicles, is providing consumers incentives and manufacturers incentives to obviously consumers incentives to buy cars, manufacturers incentives to build them and to have them built in the United States. So that's number one. Number two, some of the key ingredients in all of this, and batteries is not something we do a lot of now in the United States. In fact, our global market share of batteries is, like, I think, 7%, maybe even less. And China's global percentage of lithium ion batteries is like 60% or above. And I think that knowing that this administration wants to wean us off dependence of critical materials like lithium ion batteries is also pushing investments like this. So I think that's important. The Buy America rules that you talk about, like the fact that these vehicles would be eligible to be purchased by the federal government if they're made in America, is a big thing. And certainly, and I would say this is kind of a continuation of policy from the prior administration, the Democratic Congress. The new rules of the USMCA, that's the trade agreement with Mexico and Canada, will specify that a higher percentage of vehicles to be tariff-free have to be made in America, and the big components especially have to be made in America, and they need to be made with good wages as well. And so I think that is an important factor, and that's obviously something that the Trump administration negotiated with Mexico and Canada, but Nancy Pelosi, other key Democrats, Sherrod Brown, Ron Wyden, pushed them in that direction on some of this. And then the question that I know people are asking is like, well, are these going to be good jobs? Are these going to be union jobs? Or is this going to be more migration of work from the Midwest to the South. And in Tennessee and Kentucky, it is a more complex question, say, than it is in Alabama, Mississippi, or Georgia.
Right, because I'll be honest with you, Scott. The first thing when I saw this, I'm going, we couldn't have put this in Detroit and Cleveland or Pittsburgh. It's got to go to Kentucky and Tennessee. I'll be honest. I want strong unionized states to be rewarded with these kind of jobs because they need them. They've been for so long left behind in investment, and I think this is something that we need to help build those communities back up.
Yeah, and hopefully the public officials, the Biden administration, the UAW, and allies will be able to hold the company to account and to neutrality here. It's worth pointing out that Ford has a unionized big plant in Louisville already that manufactures vehicles. GM obviously is not making this investment, but GM has a unionized facility in Spring Hill, Tennessee, and also in Bowling Green, Kentucky. There are also examples of automakers in Kentucky and Tennessee that aren't unionized. Volkswagen and Toyota come to mind, for instance, but there is a fighting chance here, I think, and a reasonably good one. So, but it's a great day. I remember, and Rick, I'm sure you do this too, and this is something that I remember people saying like a decade ago or more, well, manufacturing jobs are never coming back. We're never going to see those big factories again. We're going to never see those big job numbers. It's all going to be robots or made in China, and we're never going to see this again. And I don't know how many times I heard it. I'm sure you heard it too. Every time it made my ears bleed, and it burned my blood too, because I do think with policy that we can get things done. And, yep. And that's a clear example here. So this positions the United States to assume more global leadership in electric vehicles, in battery manufacturing, which obviously is where this industry is headed. I'm glad that we're making this investment in the United States, as opposed to seeing these companies flee and try to bring the vehicles in from China.
Right. Now I understand that
other places as well.
Yeah, I understand that Ford is partnering with a Korean company, I guess SK. Just as we've seen General Motors, who I guess they're building battery plants in Ohio and Tennessee as well, and they've got a partner, this LG Energy. Yep. So we're seeing the kind of investment that we need in this technology, which I hope leads to us making more vehicles here at home, so it makes it a lot easier for me to buy my next vehicle.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, lithium-ion batteries are heavy. they're not easy to ship places. So the assembly of those is going to take place very close to where those batteries are located. That's just kind of the nature of the business. And plus, you get that symbiotic relationship between the innovation, what's working on the plant floor, and there really is no substitute for that. It's hard to do it when the manufacturing is an ocean away. A lot easier to do it when it's across the street. And so there's all sorts of good business reasons to believe that this kind of model will succeed. And hopefully, now I'm also going to point out that Ford, none of these other companies are perfect. Like the Mach-E, the really cool electric Mustang, it's made in Mexico.
Yep.
Unfortunately. And so we still have a lot of work to do to get more of that production in the United States, but this is a big step forward.
No, I mean, for me, it's the signal in this, and I'm glad you brought up the change in our trade rules. The signal in this for me is that we're no longer just going to be the final assembly place where we slap a name on it and say, hey, it was made in the U.S. Well, we're actually going to be manufacturing stuff, because you hit on it a second ago. Out of that manufacturing facility then comes the next generation of tinkers and innovators and entrepreneurs who are going to change the future. Once you lose those people who go in their garage and go, hey, I can do this differently, I think you lose something.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You sure do. And that's what and it creates this whiplash effect that we've seen. We saw the jobs get outsourced. We saw, Wall Street totally bet against American manufacturing, want to push everything overseas. The consequence of that is that manufacturing curriculum, both hands-on and knowledge taken out of the schools, it's getting its way back in. but you lose that. And so when you build things like this, you develop it, and you develop the research and development too, both the academic research and development, the hands-on research and development, and you'll see these ecosystems develop. And so I'm super excited about it. I mean, there are, you know, this announcement didn't have it, but I mean, there are electric vehicles that are going to be made in Michigan too, which is also exciting. And so I think I would have been more disturbed if this was like a Deep South announcement or something like that. But these are places where the GM and the UAW, or I mean the car makers and the UAW have been able to have successful efforts together. And so I hope that these plants follow that model.
No, I'm right there with you. And I look at Joe Biden as the most pro-union president of my lifetime, at least. And I hope that the push will be to make sure that those jobs are good, solid, family wage sustaining jobs with union rights and health care and all of that stuff, so that we all do better as we all do better. But on this battery front, I'm excited by the fact that this will open up, I think, a whole nother avenue when you start looking at our climate issues with solar panels and energy storage. This can give us, I hope, another leg forward in being able to address those issues, to where, you know, if we're going to put solar panels everywhere, they should be made here, and the storage should be made here, to give us the ability to do as much as we can, and, well, also that we benefit from it.
Yeah. And so I think this is a really important question, Rick, because the media likes to play up differences. And one of the differences they like to play up is that, well, the climate urgency, the fact that we have to bring this on board because to avert a crisis. And in order to do that, we might have to get the cheap stuff from overseas rather than making it in the United States. That's kind of how the argument plays out. The truth of it is, we can do both. We have to do both, because it's not going to be acceptable to the American people to simply trade foreign oil for made in China solar panels. And so I do think that this administration understands that and understands that with procurement rules, as you mentioned, with trade rules, with the right demand incentives, that you can make it you can make it cost effective to manufacture these in the United States and pay good wages. And there is absolutely no reason why any solar developer or other one, you know, or other clean energy developer anywhere should need to depend on goods they're made in terrible conditions, sometimes with forced labor, in Xinjiang, you know, China, where a lot of the polysilicon comes for solar panels, or in a way that is harming the environment at the same time that you're trying to solve it. And so having that production in the United States is a win for workers, is a win for the environment, and ultimately is going to be a win for climate, because you're going to build more political support for these efforts if folks see jobs, good jobs in particular, coming along with them.
No, I'm looking forward to it. I'm hoping it comes out. I'm hoping it's everything that we're told it's going to be. I'm hope it's the 11,000 jobs that they're claiming. I hope it's not a Foxconn kind of deal where they're promising 13,000 jobs and we get maybe 100. I'm hoping that these are good family sustaining wage jobs that help build communities and do the things that we need to do. A good day, in my view. Before I let you go, I understand Thursday you are going to be hosting the Steel Strong virtual roundtable with a couple of members of Congress, some labor leaders. You're going to have our congressman here in Pennsylvania, Connor Lamb, and others on talking about why we need strong steel, why we need to make sure that we have it in the steel industry. Tell me a little bit about what you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And anybody can join in and watch. The link is on our website, AmericanManufacturing.org. This event comes at a critical time, because the Section 232 tariffs on imported steel are under review, and they're certainly under attack by the European Union, that doesn't think that they should be subject to these tariffs, even though there are more than 30 anti-dumping and countervailing duty cases against metals coming from Europe right now. We have a metals trade deficit with Europe that's substantial. And quite honestly, Rick, Europe hasn't been a reliable partner yet in taking on China. I mean, it needs to step up and do more. And so I think what the CEOs, what Tom Conway, the president of the steelworkers, going to say, what members of Congress are going to say, it's like, you know, we are steel production is coming back in the United States. Now, it's not the Donald Trump 1950s way. It's obviously a lot different than that. But these companies are adding jobs. They're making new investments. They're making investments in decarbonization as we move forward as well. They're excited about contributing to the infrastructure investment that we may be making. They need the tariffs because this problem globally still isn't solved. China makes too much steel. Everybody else tries to replicate that. For U.S. firms that depend on an operating functioning market, it bites them. And so that's why we have these tariffs in place. And so I think the story that's going to be told is that they've added good jobs, and the jobs in union steel mills are great jobs. They're some of the best middle-class jobs you can find, and they support tons of other jobs in these communities. And so overall, even though steel's a small part of the economy, in a lot of these communities, you know, and you know them in Pennsylvania and Ohio and a lot of these other places, Rick, these communities depend on the steel jobs. Overall, our economy seems to be doing fine. We're adding jobs. We're growing. Obviously, there's equity and other issues that we need to address. But the steel tariffs aren't killing growth. They're not killing jobs. They're not doing anything about that. I mean, companies that consume steel complain about it because they think it cuts into their margins a little bit. But they're all still making a lot of money. They're making a lot of money. And so it's much better to have a steel industry that's thriving and competitive in the United States than to completely depend on China or other countries as we're trying to rebuild up the auto industry, the clean energy economy in the U.S. here. We can do it, and so that's one of the messages that I think the participants are going to relay at this Thursday event. I hope folks will have a chance to tune into it.
Yeah, and if they don't catch it live, it'll be there that they can stream it later on. Yeah. Everything's always there and on demand. AmericanManufacturing.org, that website. And you know me, I'm a big supporter of domestic production, domestic consumption. So keeping a strong steel industry, important if we're going to make those batteries, if we're going to make those solar panels, if we're going to build those wind turbines, we need to protect our steel industry. Seems pretty simple to me, and I'm glad that we've got some policymakers that are thinking finally in that direction. So good stuff. But Scott, I appreciate the time. As always, great talking with you.
All right. Rick, thanks for having me on. Appreciate all the great work you do as well.
Good stuff. Our good friend Scott Paul, the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Make sure you check out their website, AmericanManufacturing.org, and check out that virtual roundtable. I think it's going to be an interesting discussion. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back. Stick around.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1904. A woman was arrested for smoking a cigarette in a car on Fifth Avenue in New York City. While women in the United States are no longer likely to be arrested for smoking cigarettes in public, they continue to face unequal treatment in the labor force. When women started working in factories in the mid-1800s, most notably textile mills, owners paid them far less than men for similar labor. In fact, it was because they saw women as a cheap labor pool that many textile factory owners favored female workers. Today, a woman will earn about 80 cents for every dollar a man earns. Even though women have increased their presence in higher-paying jobs traditionally dominated by men, women as a whole continue to work in low-paying occupations. Women are about twice as likely as men to say that they've been discriminated against at work because of their gender. In January of 2009, President Barack Obama signed into law the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. It was named after a woman who fought for 10 years against gender pay discrimination at the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company. She was awarded a $3 million jury settlement, but that ruling was later overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court. The 2009 Act strengthened women's ability to seek legal recourse over pay discrimination. Still, today, the rate of women's compensation lags behind that of men. Labor unions must continue to play a role in fighting against pay inequity.
This union maid was wise to the tricks of the company spies. She'd never be fooled by a company stool. She'd always organize the guys. She'd always get her way. When she asked for better pay, she'd show her.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryint.com.
Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the union.